Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Thank you once again for joining us. Don't you welcome them, Rabbit?
Of course I do, yeah. We're delighted that you're with us again today on this wonderful day, whatever day of the week you're listening, actually, because we can never tell.
Right. But, and we're going to jump to San Diego.
We are, because it's a, first of all, it's a beautiful place to be. Thank goodness it's far enough away from wildfires in Los Angeles right now. And it's beautiful that every season, but fall is probably one of its best. And I had the opportunity while I was out there to talk with Kate Busker, who's an old friend from the San Diego Convention and Visitors Bureau, to get a review of some of the main sites and all the exciting events that are coming up this fall season. And also to drop in on a great new restaurant called Vela, meaning sail, in a magnificent new Hilton Hotel right next to the convention center and very close to the San Diego Padres baseball park. Those two interviews will give you an excellent insight into what you might enjoy if you head for the far southwest of San Diego sometime during the fall, which would certainly be a great idea, we think. So shall we go to the tape?
Go now.
Peter's been spending summertime in San Diego, which is beautiful weather-wise, but there are a whole lot of... So it might not be the best season if you're into really appreciating what this delightful part of the United States has to offer. So I'm going to offer you a preview today about what to do in the upcoming fall season in San Diego, and what better person to tell us about it than Kate Busker with the San Diego Convention and Visitors Bureau. Kate, welcome back to On the Menu Radio. Here's the mic. Tell us all about fall in San Diego.
Peter, it's so good to have you back here and to be connecting again with the listeners of On the Menu Radio. We are delighted to have you here. It is summer. It is busy. It is beautiful. But I think when you tell your listeners that fall is a really special time in San Diego, that the tourists go home, everybody's back in school, and you kind of have the destination to yourself. I often tell people it's one of the best times of year to visit simply because our weather is gorgeous all the way through October. It's summer weather. The water's warm. You can be out on the beaches. And certainly, we still have the full flush of the summer produce coming through. Fantastic food in the farmers markets, of which there is one every day in San Diego. We've got great farmers markets in Coronado, Little Italy, Hillcrest. Beautiful farmers markets every day. So you can go and sample fresh produce straight from the farm. Or certainly visit any of the restaurants, which I know you've been doing while you're here. In addition to just great food and fabulous weather and a lack of crowds, fall brings a lot of really great culinary events to San Diego. Beginning in September, we have San Diego Restaurant Week, which is entering into its fifth year. It's been a huge success at offering visitors and locals the opportunity to dine for a very affordable price at some of the best restaurants in town. So from September 13th through 18th, they will be offering $20, $30, and $40 menus in over 150 restaurants all over town. You can come, make reservations anytime between September 13th and 18th, and dine at some of San Diego's best restaurants for barely any money, really, for what you're getting from the restaurants. That's a fabulous September event, but we actually have great events throughout the fall. In October, we have Celebrate the Craft, which is at the Lodge at Torrey Pines, which is one of the most beautiful settings in San Diego, right along the Torrey Pines State Reserve, which is the only place you can see the Torrey Pines tree in all of the contiguous U.S. From October 31st through November 1st, the chefs from the San Diego region will be gathering to celebrate the craft, to celebrate the food and the products that are made here locally that they use every day. So they'll be gathering with cheesemakers and farmers and winemakers to do a beautiful reception on the lawn at the Lodge at Torrey Pines. They actually invite plein air artists to come and paint the Torrey Pines State Reserve, and they sell the paintings. The beautiful celebration of the beauty of San Diego, the beauty of San Diego's food and dining scene, and it's fabulous, and that's October 31st through November 1st. But it really doesn't stop there. We actually have just the next week, November 6th through 15th, the very first ever San Diego Beer Week is kicking off. I don't know if you and I have had a chance to talk about this, Peter, but San Diego has one of the best craft beer scenes in the country. We have over 30 incredible award-winning breweries here. And so it's become really a destination among people who know craft beer. And this year, San Diego's restaurants, bars, hotels are teaming up to celebrate the successes of the regional breweries with a San Diego Beer Week. There'll be tastings, chef dinners, events, all around town between November 6th and November 15th. It's a 10-day celebration that kicks off on November 6th and 7th with the San Diego Brewers Guild Beer Festival in Balboa Park. We'll have more than 80 locally brewed beers on tap. Brewers will all be there to talk about it. It's going to be a whole week of fabulous events.
Now, just in case, listeners, you didn't make a note of all of that, Kate, there has to be a place where people can go to get an update on all this stuff that the Convention and Visit Bureau puts out. So why don't you give us that website?
Absolutely, Peter. You can research all this information. It will all be posted on our website at sandiego.org. And we actually have a blog that I write about all the fun dining things that are going on. So if you go to sandiego.org and click on our blog, you can read about these events and all the new restaurants and everything that's happening in the dining scene.
There are some very special things that San Diego is known for anyway, like the zoo and the aquarium. So for those listeners who never heard about those, why don't you mention those too?
Absolutely. You can eat the whole time you're here, but it might be nice to walk off some of those fabulous meals you have. Balboa Park is the largest urban cultural park in the U.S. That's where the famous San Diego Zoo is located. And the San Diego Zoo just in May opened up their brand new Elephant Odyssey exhibit, which if visitors haven't been here recently, is a really incredible exhibit with a whole herd of 8 elephants living and in a area together. And they also have great focus on conservation of the zoo in general. But this exhibit draws the parallels between the animals in Southern California that are prehistoric, like the woolly mammoth, and today's modern endangered animals all over the world. So it's a great educational exhibit, and also really fun to see the elephants. SeaWorld, of course, is a fabulous exhibit with Shamu. They've got new shows all the time, especially in the fall. You're kind of leading up to the holiday season when they have great holiday shows with Shamu and all his friends. In addition, I think just visiting the downtown area, the fabulous Gaslamp Quarter, beautiful Mission Bay Park, all the neighborhoods in San Diego. Certainly if you visit sandiego.org, you'll find lots of exciting things to do when you're not out eating.
Now, before we move to a particular food scene that we've enjoyed this evening, Kev, we just have to put in a plug for where we're sitting right now, which is a new hotel landmark on the San Diego scene.
Absolutely. We're lucky enough to be dining tonight at the beautiful Hilton San Diego Bayfront, which is located right on San Diego Bay downtown. It's a brand new hotel, very beautiful, chic, modern design, open and airy, reflects the feeling of the bay. It opened just back in December, so it's one of San Diego's newest hotels, certainly one of the most exciting. So we're really, it's lovely always to be on San Diego Bay, but certainly to be in this beautiful new hotel.
Kate, thank you so much for your welcome to San Diego. And listeners, this is it's one of those places on the planet that is blessed with a wonderful climate. It's blessed with a wonderful crowd of people as well, especially when the people from elsewhere have gone away. We really shouldn't say that because we're still here in the summer season, but it is much pleasanter here when there are less people, don't you think?
Well, of course, Peter, I'm never going to say that. I want a ton of people here all the time. But I certainly think for listeners that are in the know, it's certainly fabulous to come in fall because you kind of do have San Diego all to yourself.
Okay, listeners, figure this one out. And Adam, named after our son, of course, Bussell, is from where?
Right here in San Diego.
That's hard to believe. Now, ethnically, Bussell is?
Gosh, you got me on the spot here. I believe it is, I have Polish and Danish back. It's one or the other.
Well, we just recorded an interview with Kate Buska from the San Diego Convention Visitor Bureau, but we're sitting in this delightful restaurant called Vela, which means sail, which is appropriate because if you look out the window, there are sailing boats everywhere. We're in glorious San Diego. We just had an absolutely delicious dinner. Dessert is still on the table, so we haven't done that one yet. But we thought we'd better catch Chef while he had a free moment to talk to us about what's happening here in this magnificent restaurant in this great new hotel. Adam, welcome to On the Menu. Tell us the story.
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. And been open for just about 10 months, and going through growing pains, being a new restaurant, this type of economy isn't the best time to open a new restaurant. But fortunately, we have the backing of our hotel to support us. And we're starting to get some embrace from San Diego and not just the business travelers that come to the the Hilton for conventions.
Now, you have a theme on your menu that says there's at least one local ingredient in every dish, but I'm sure you strive for more than that. Tell us about that program.
I just try really hard. I mean, living in San Diego it's not that hard to outsource local ingredients. I'm sure that 90% of the ingredients throughout the U.S. come from Southern California, so I have them all here at my fingertips. I deal with my purveyors to search out local and organic produce. There's farms just up the road. There's local farmers markets, and it's really not that hard to use stuff that's right here in our own backyard.
But it's not just like a feel like. I mean, it's really a commitment that you've made.
You have to make that decision and commit to it. But it's fun. And it's enjoyable, and it's interesting. Until you try, you never realize how easy it is to use ingredients that are local, and you never realize the impact of when you're buying things from all over the world what is actually taking place.
Now, you're going beyond vegetable and fruit products as well, right? So you're sourcing your meat also from California as close by as you can?
All of our seafood is locally fished. Our meat is currently from Montana, unfortunately, but there is a local Southern California homegrown meats that we're trying to do business with currently.
That's just the ingredient side of it. Now, we the opportunity to sample the eye candy and the delicious taste of the things that you put on our plates, but why don't you give our listeners a taste of what it was you presented for Kate and Peter this evening?
I'd love to. Everything that I do is fairly simple. I definitely emphasize the ingredients themselves. I never try to mask anything, overdo anything, or do something that just doesn't make sense. I find the best things that I can, prepare them very simply, and give them to the guest.
So run down just some of the items that you sent us out to sample this evening.
You guys got to try the local peach salad. Stone fruit is great right now. We had local peaches with some pata negra, which is a Spanish Iberian ham, which is a great product, very pricey, but you just need a little to make a huge impact. We also went with the white prawn escabeche. These are Mexican shrimp that are fished not far from here and cooked and marinated in vinegar. It's served with an avocado puree.
They were absolutely delicious. So they're wild and from just down the road?
Yes, they're not far from here. I mean, if you know where San Diego is, you know that we're about 15 minutes from the border, and just south of the border, some very great seafood comes from there.
So we're getting some of the food miles back from Jose Andres's Pata Negra. But we went on beyond that to an unusual source of mussels, which were quite delicious. They're local, and then you paired them with something a little more exotic.
Yes, the mussels come from Carlsbad Aqua Farm. It's a local aqua farm that's just in an inlet 20 minutes away. So it's very unique, and it's convenient, and it's great. We don't have to get mussels from New Zealand or the East Coast. We get them right here on the West Coast, and they're a great product. And I paired them with black garlic. And black garlic is kind of a newer thing on the scene. It's kind of hot right now. Garlic that's basically fermented for 30 days in a dark room, and it's a great ingredient. It's got a very unique flavor. The little black garlic and Spanish chorizo goes a long way with some local fresh mussels.
Okay, and then for our encore, our main course, you had some salmon and some steak on the same plate.
I paired two items that are currently on the menu for you guys. I did the Meyer flat iron steak. Flat iron's a popular piece of meat right now because you don't have to charge an arm and a leg to get a great flavorful cut of meat. I use all Meyer natural beef, and it's a fabulous product. I pair that with a romesco sauce made of Spanish almonds, roasted peppers, and some sherry vinegar, and a salsa verde, and some local asparagus. And then with the fish, wild salmon is in season right now, so I did some local yellow wax beans from Crow's Pass Farms, which is a local farmer that supply some great, amazing stuff for us here at Vela, and some roasted tomatoes and a little sherry emulsion.
I think there was some There was some pork on the menu that you're very proud of, but we missed that one because our capacity was complete. Is that local?
From the West Coast. It's from Oregon, and it's a large 14-ounce, very thick cut pork chop. The Berkshire-style pig, very juicy, very tender, and extremely flavorful. And it's served with some pancetta. You have to do pork on pork, I think, sometimes. And some wilted local greens and some creamy polenta and a little salty caramel sauce.
And let's hear a last word for the delicious display that is right behind the recording system. I'm looking at it, which is four desserts which look so good. Sweetheart, I'm going to be tempted. I just have to have a taste, although you know I don't have a sweet tooth any more than you do. So, Adam, just lead us through this quartet.
We have some great desserts. These actually just rolled out this week. I have a chocolate dome with a chocolate mousse and a saffron panna cotta center. I also have a chèvre, which is French goat cheesecake with toasted almonds and a balsamic caramel. I have a vanilla bourbon creme brulee for this week, and we changed our creme brulee weekly. And then I have a pumpkin pie, a play on that, with a praline ice cream and a black chiffon cake going into the fall time flavors there.
And let's just put in a mention for the wonderful wine program lady who came by earlier on, who's not here at this moment, but who's certainly going to take care of you when you're here. Her name is Megan Yelanowski. And Megan talked to us earlier and said she's sitting her Master Sommelier exam this year, so you can be sure that there's going to be a wine program to match all the wonderful food that's available here at Vela Restaurant in the Hilton Bayshore, San Diego Bayfront, thank you, Kate, right next to the convention center, the other side of the convention center from the Marriott Hotel, closer and much more convenient to the guest lounge quarter. And you'll have a good time here. This is a very stylish hotel and a very stylish restaurant. And we want to thank Chef Adam for taking care of us this evening. Chef Adam, thank you. Do you have a last thought for listeners before we go away? A last thought for our, I should have said listeners, not listeners. Adam can't think of anything wittier to say than you should come here because when you do, I'll take really good care of you. Did I say that right?
That was perfect. That was great, Peter.
Thank you for a beautiful evening in San Diego. And listeners, you'll be well taken care of here for sure. So we recommend it.
Well, it's now time to take a break, right?
It is. So we'll take one.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Please remember to keep in touch with us. Just go on the website and click through with emails and Twitters and Facebook and everything like that.
All this other magic stuff that Ann does.
The blog, and
a blog
Peter does.
Yeah, well, he gets around to it just every once in a while. I'm kind of a lazy blogger these days.
Yeah.
But there's so much blogging going on out there, and Ann's just twittering the world to death, so that's probably the best way to make sure that you get in touch with us anyway.
Right. Now we're going to introduce our listeners to, I'm very pleased that they came into our life, these kitchen table bakers, because I like this product.
Yeah, it's a fascinating family life story that became a product, became a business, that you'll just find delightful. And the funny part about it is reinventing a traditional Eastern Italian dish called fricos,
right,
but in a very special way. So if you have a frico, don't worry. You'll be able to have something coming very close to that when you get involved with Kitchen Table's Baker's Parmesan wafers. But here's
Chris,
a nice young man with the story. Parmesan crisps, I'm sorry.
Growing up in England, we were always taught that the moon was made out of green cheese. But I don't think we ever expected in our lifetime that we would come across a product that's conventionally made from flour with gluten, that's now made from cheese. So when we found Seth Novick and his fascinating product, we said, you know what, this is something so different, we have to bring it to you.
Yeah, hi, Seth.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Okay.
So you didn't know where I was going to go there.
I didn't even know you were going to talk. I usually do the introduction.
Well, you didn't start, so I figured I would start.
All right. Is it blue cheese or green cheese? Green cheese, you're right.
The moon is made of green cheese, and there is a man on the moon as well, because you can see, because he has a smile on his face.
I can see him, I know.
But that's not why we're here today. We're here to talk about crackers.
I have a segue. If you eat these crackers, you'll have a smile on your face.
Okay.
We like to hear that. We like to hear people say that. And thankfully, we do have a nice audience, and people that really take to us. We call them crisps because, you know, usually when you think of a cracker, you think of a flour cracker. And we have no flour, no wheat, no gluten of any sort. It is 100% Parmesan cheese that we have a special baking process that you get the delicious crispness minus the wheat, the gluten, and any type of flour, rice flour. It is 100% Parmesan cheese.
And it tastes like it. It's just wonderful. Tell us where you got the idea. I guessed at it a little bit, but you're right on trend for the gluten-free, but also there was the carb issue, right?
Yes. We started the company way back during the no-carb, low-carb boom, and before the name Kitchen Table Bakers came to fruition, we were the no-carb kitchen.
Yeah, let's get that name out there because it's cute, too, and I was going to ask you to tell us about it after you tell us your motivation for the crisps. Kitchen Table Bakers.
Yes, so our company is a family company. It's my father and myself, and we've, of course, hired other people, but it is essentially the two of us making the day-to-day decisions. And like I just stated, we started as a no-carb product. Dad was on the no-carb diet and saw a recipe in the New York Times food section about these Parmesan crisps that were just Parmesan cheese and delicious. So he tried it out because following the no-carb diet, you were always looking for a salty, crunchy snack, and that was, you know, most of those flavors were in a cracker that you couldn't eat, or they tasted like cardboard or were not so appealing. And we stumbled upon Parmesan. We called them cheese crackers.
Uh-huh.
But it was only cheese. And
you didn't invent this idea then. Somebody else did?
No, we cannot take credit for inventing it. People have been making Parmesan wafers or cheese crackers for a long time. We were the first ones to maybe add some flavoring into it and to try to package it and sell it.
Okay. Is there any similarity to the concept behind Frikos, the Friolian?
Exactly what we are. We're a Friko. So some people come along and say cheese cracker, but a lot of people at trade shows that know Simlifogs call them Frikos. And, you know, we were thinking about calling them that, but we wanted to have our own unique Parmesan crisp. So you don't confuse it with a flour cracker because you do pay a premium for our product because Parmesan cheese is a lot more expensive than, you know, buying flour to make a cracker.
Yeah, and this is what I was thinking. Getting really good Parmesan is expensive. So, I mean, how do you control costs?
Well, we have our Parmesan is domestic. We don't, if we were to use Parmesan or Reggiano from Italy, it couldn't work. We were lucky enough to be set up with some great domestic Parmesan cheese makers that are out in Wisconsin, that Parmesan to the specifications we need for taste, for color, for everything that we need for the texture. So it's a lot of science involved as much as it is cooking.
Now, you got the cheesemakers on board after you'd already started, right? So initially you were beginning with just like store-bought.
Exactly. We would go into our local Costco. We would go and fill our entire cart of all the time. We would go to every Costco in the region and bring our Ford Explorer and fill up the car with all the Parmesan cheese. We'd clear them out, go to the next one, fill the car up, and that, to be completely honest, that is how we got our start with Parmesan cheese from Costco. And then we looked on the bottom of the bag of, you know, who's distributing that cheese. We got in touch with them, and then we had a cheese distributor that would, you know, ship us pallets instead of us having to go to Costco every few days.
Now, we should explain, listeners, that the company is based in Syosset, which I think is Long Island, New York, am I right?
That's correct, yes.
So it's not exactly your conventional location. That just happens to be where you and Dad make your home?
Yes, that is correct? And Flyacid, I live in Manhattan, so it's about an hour outside of Manhattan. So we have access to everything you need in Manhattan.
Now, I picture trailer trucks pulled up outside your establishment saying, Parmesan and cheese on the air. I mean, how much in an average week, how much Parmesan cheese do you now go through?
Oh, we go through a lot of cheese. We get pallets of Parmesan cheese delivered. They come in about 40-pound blocks is how we've been getting it recently, and then we ship and we grate it to get our nice consistency. About 2,000 pounds at a time on these pallets, and we've got a large, we are of course no longer doing it out of our house. We've got a facility in East Rutherford, New Jersey,
Parmesan cheese by the ton. I mean, what a mental picture. I mean, these cheeses are pretty big, but a ton is a lot of them.
Yeah, it is a lot.
Seth, now, were you in food manufacturing or a food-related business before?
No, not at all. Like you guys, I have a wanderlust. I'm an avid traveler, and after I finished university, I went to Prague. I taught English in Prague for a year.
Oh, you were one of those. Do you know that the guy who wrote the Prague book?
David Farley, wasn't it?
David Farley.
You know what? I have not read it, but yes, I do know of it.
Yeah, he just came out with another one, a relic in this town in Italy
called the foreskin of Christ. But that's a story for another day. We haven't decided whether that's suitable material for a full length interview on the menu yet. And I only got partway through the book, but we sure got a long way into Parmesan crisps from kitchen table bakers.
I gave them the ultimate test. I took them to our swim club, and they're very picky eaters and a lot of foodies in the group, and they lapped them up.
Now you've now got a variety of different flavors, right?
Yes, that is correct. We have 8 flavors. Of course, we started with just the aged Parmesan as the base, and that is still the base of all the flavors. We don't put any flour, rice flour, any sort. We have a garlic, a sesame, a jalapeno, a rosemary, a flaxseed, and my favorite is the everything. It tastes like an everything bagel with garlic, onions, poppy seeds, and sesame seeds. But each of them are so unique. Even though they are all Parmesan cheese, each of the mixing flavors really, really stand out. And there's a uniqueness with each and every one of them.
And how do people get a hold of them?
Oh, I was going to say, we just finished a box of, the sesame ones? So we're now faced with the choice of which ones to open next. But I'm sure we're spot for choice, but we'll figure out something nice.
I already opened another one.
You already opened another one.
They're a little addictive, you have to admit.
Anne's crackers about crackers. Now back to Anne's question. Where can people satisfy their lust for this wonderful product?
People can, at a lot of high-end gourmet shops throughout the country, don't have a retail finder, but we sell to Wegmans, Fresh Market, Whole Foods, and you can visit our website, kitchentablebakers.com, with links to other online retailers that sell our product. And if the listeners want to call us, you can be reached at 800-486-4582, and we can try to find a place that's close to them where they can go purchase it.
Well, and we should mention that you won.
No, I was going to do that. Yeah, we're on the same page. Not only do we like these, and not only do the owners like these, but the Sophie judges at the Fancy Food Show also liked them very much and gave them a special award. I'm sure you remember the category better than we do.
Most outstanding diet and lifestyle product. I thought that was an unusual category.
Well, that's where we fit, because we are
gluten-free.
And that has been such a huge part of our business. People with celiac disease is a fast, prevalence. People keep getting diagnosed.
I don't know. Is it because they're getting diagnosed more, or is it because they're really becoming more?
No, it's just being diagnosed more. The people are out there that have had stomach issues for a long time, and now they're going to get tested for it and finding out that they do have a wheat and gluten allergy. And people that have it go on this diet where they just cut out all wheat and gluten, and their whole diet has to change. You know, people have been eating bread and grains for their entire life, and then they say, you can't have that anymore. And not to say all products that are wheat and gluten aren't tasty, but a lot of them are missing that gourmet aspect that we have. Our claim is we're a gourmet product that just happens to be wheat and gluten free, which is true. We didn't set out to make a wheat and gluten product, gluten free product. We kind of stumbled into it and said it's an extra bonus for people that
are on these food diets. That's a good way to approach it, Seth.
Well, it's a great story of commercializing something that you just made because it suited your dad's diet, and we're delighted. Our friends are delighted, and listeners, you'll be delighted too if you get some of this wonderful product. Again, what's the name again, sweetheart?
It's called Kitchen Table Bakers, and the product is called the Parmesan Crisps, right?
Yes, Parmesan Crisps. We have 8 different flavors. We just released the Mini Crisps, is what we won the Sophie Gold. We were pleased to get the silver medal, and then they had a really nice ceremony at the end of the fancy food show in the summer, where they had all the nominees, and Kitchen Table Bakers were lucky enough to win the gold. And I don't know if you know the celebrity chef Minsai, but he was
there. We were there. We were at the show. Yeah.
It was a really nice little coup for the company, and we were very pleased.
Well, okay. Lots of continuing luck.
Yeah, congratulations.
And success. And it's not luck, it's hard work, but lots of good success.
And keep those cheese crisps coming. I still have this mental picture of the man in the moon eating Parmesan crisps. Thank you so much.
Sure will. And we thank you here from Kitchen Table Bakers for taking the time to talk to us. And
our pleasure, Seth.
Please give us a call if you need anything. Visit our website. Become a fan of ours on Facebook. And thank you again, guys.
Thanks, Seth. Bye-bye. And I think now we will take a pause, or we will pause while I go grab one of those crisps.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And what flavor crisp did you get, my dear?
Jalapeno Parmesan.
Jalapeno is the one we're eating at the moment, huh?
Right.
There we go. Well, it's pretty exciting stuff, but...
Well, now we're getting into something that's become a sort of accidentally a focus of our attention, fruit breeding. But this is a very elegantly written book by Chip Bradley, and he'll explain what it is. It's about the pluot.
It's a really rather fascinating...
Or the plum cause.
It's a really rather fascinating story about why... Californians are jealous of apples, but they make plum cots or pluots or whatever they're called. And
Chip is a really fine writer.
Chip wrote this wonderful book all about it and then took the time to explain it all to us. So I'm sure that you're going to find it really quite fascinating. So here's Chip Brantley talking all about pluots.
Chip Brantley is a co-founder of cookthink.com, which I'll ask you about in a minute, Chip. Welcome to On the Menu. We're here to talk about your new book, and congratulations. It's getting marvelous reception.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the congratulations.
Now, the book is called The Perfect Fruit, Good
Right.
Breeding, Bad Seeds, and the Hunt for the Elusive Pluot. I read it cover to cover, I want you to know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and what I couldn't figure out is, I don't mean to say, why did you write it? What I mean to say is the descriptions of all the testimonies in the back of the jacket described it as, or its mission or its purpose, differently. Did you notice that?
It was interesting. And a lot of the people who have read the book and talked to me about it, it seems like a lot of people have different things to be interested in the book, which might be in part a result of kind of how I came about writing. Came at all the research went into the book. In fits and starts, and so it definitely has a, I won't say a hodgepodge, it has a little bit of everything, I think, in it.
Well, how would you, now, Barbara Kafka, who's a good friend, we love Barbara, she describes this book as a love affair, and I didn't get that.
Well, Barbara and I have, we've become friends through CookThink, which is the website you mentioned that I co-founded with a buddy of mine, and we've done some work with Barbara. And Barbara and I just started, when Barbara and I just got to know each other, we, my wife and I, Elizabeth, had just had our first and for now only child. And so Barbara got a lot of personal details, I think, some other people about my life that, that maybe other people who have read the book and wrote a copy for the back of the book maybe didn't have access to.
Uh-huh.
So writing this book was a little bit like the male equivalent of having a baby.
Well, I would never claim to know anything about what it's like to have a baby, because it's just a straight avenue to trouble right there.
Well, now, what is your rationale for writing the book?
Well, truthfully, you know, I started out, like I said, taking a bite out of a plum out at a farmer's market in Los Angeles, and it was unlike any plum I'd ever had, and I didn't really know what it was. It sort of looked like a plum, and I tried to find out what it was, and over the course of doing that, the story of the pluot and how it came to be and how it's grown became more and more interesting, and that's partly because I didn't know that much about fruit breeding. Actually, I should say I didn't know anything about fruit breeding. I didn't know that really that there existed such a thing as fruit breeding, and I wasn't that familiar with even how fruit is grown. And so I went from knowing nothing to, in about a year, trying to learn a little bit about how a fruit comes into being. And several years passed, and I found myself spending more and more time in fruit orchards in Central California. And at a certain point, I had to justify all that time to nobody else, at least to myself. And so I began to think of it as a book.
I see.
Now, had you written books before?
No, this is my first book. I had worked as a food writer. I started working as a food writer during the initial research for this book, and had also written about many other things, kind of a freelance writer for a while, and wrote about movies, wrote about all sorts of things. So this was my first book.
Well, what about this website that you need to explain to us?
Right. Cookthink kind of grew out of a frustration that my partner, Bryce Stevens, and I, we grew up together in Birmingham, Alabama, and we've always loved food, and we've always talked about food together, and we've always wanted to try to find a way to work together. And we kept talking about, this is several years ago now, we started Cookthink in 2006, started working on Cookthink in 2006, and, you know, we were just frustrated with the online search engines for recipes. We didn't feel like that there was a website out there that had really done recipe search in the right way, and so we set out to try to do that. And so what we created was a recipe search tool where you can search for recipes not only by ingredients, dish type, cuisine, the traditional things that we think about when we think about searching for a recipe online. And we added to that the ability to search for recipes based on more experiential qualities, like what it feels like in your mouth, what you could be craving.
Really?
To be wanting this recipe, what time of the year this recipe you would normally want to make this recipe, which occasions you might find yourself craving this recipe. So we really tried to kind of get at it from kind of reverse engineer the recipes and say, okay, you know, what would I be craving to want this recipe?
Does it work?
It works really well. We don't have a huge recipe database, so we definitely have holes in terms of what you'll find in terms of the search results. But we spent a lot of time working on fixing the search results. We launched in 2007, kind of possible to use this term now because everyone uses it for everything, but beta. We launched in a beta phase in 2007 and spent a year or so really fine-tuning the search tool, and we feel really confident now in the way it works. The main errors you'll find are just a lack of a recipe, you know, that just because the database is not as large as like an Epicurious or an All Recipe.
Well, now let's go back to pluots.
Right.
Or what used to be called plump. They used to be called plumcots.
Right, and May again.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I was trying to explain that to Peter about all the different names that are attached to this and how, I mean, I view it as a book about marketing as much as anything.
Well, that turns out to be, you know, I mean, the word pluot, I think a lot of people don't know this, and the reason a lot of people don't know this is because it is so confusing from the marketing growing side of California stone fruit, but a pluot is actually a trademark owned by one family-owned breeding company, and that's Zager Genetics, Floyd Zager, often called the creator of pluots.
You see, I think that, by the way, was one of the most the things that amaze me most is the effort to enable copyrights on actual fruit.
I know. It's amazing. I know. That's one thing that I had no idea about either, that you could patent.
I mean patent, right? Not copyright. Yeah.
Right. And so trademark is, Fluot is a trademark for the plum apricot hybrids that Zager Genetics produces and patents. So unfortunately, you can't call something a pluot. If you're, say, you're a grower of pluots or of plums, peaches, nectarines, whatever, you're a stone fruit grower in California, and you grow fruit that's been bred by some other breeder that's not the Zagers, that's also a plum apricot hybrid, you can't legally, you're not allowed to call that a pluot. And so what made this really confusing is that pluot became kind of a genericized trademark like Xerox or Q-tip, mm-hmm. because it was used so prevalently in the mid-90s when pluots first began to gain commercial acceptance. Meanwhile, there were other breeders who were breeding stone fruit, breeding up plum apricot hybrids that couldn't call their fruit pluot, and so you had this incomplete name that a lot of growers now are shying away from because they realize it's not something they can use to brand all of their plum apricot hybrids.
Now, what do you actually call it?
Well,
if you can't call it a pluot, you can call it a
plumcot. I think that's the name cot, that okay. a lot of growers are going to. And a plumcot, believe me, it gets even more confusing. So the plumcot used to be the name for generic plum apricot hybrids that were first generation crosses, meaning these fruits were the result of a plum being crossed with an apricot.
But I thought that the part of the issue was that plums have a bad rap, so that you wanted to avoid having the plum connection up
That's
front.
True, too. That's true, too. So there were a couple things going on when pluots first kind of came on the scene. One was that plums were kind of at an all-time low.
See, I knew about the prune controversy. But
right. yeah. It's similar in a lot of ways. That, you know, you have this name that has such bad connotations, you just want to get as far away from it as possible. And so pluot really fit that name, pluot, fit the bill for a lot of growers. And sort of adding to pluot's cachet was the fact that plumcot also had kind of bad connotations because they were, at least among growers, not very reliable. They dropped a lot off the tree before they were ready. They cracked. They weren't big producers on the tree, so you would get a really low yield of fruit.
Right, so it wasn't a very successful crop.
Right. So,
but you know, on the whole, though, we told you that we interviewed this apple breeder.
Right.
And they seem to be so much more organized than these stone fruit guys.
That's right. Well, you know, don't bring up apples anytime you go talk to stone fruit growers in California.
Why?
It's a combination of
envy and
yeah, exactly. Jealousy. Both at the durability of the fruit. You know,
sure.
An apple can last months and months and months in storage, where a plum will, you know, rot if you look at it wrong. So I think they're jealous of that. And actually, stone fruit growers learned a lot, I think, from looking at the apple industry, because as you may have talked about with this apple breeder, Red Delicious apples were kind of probably among fruit growers everywhere, a real lesson, because apple growers for the longest time kept going towards varieties like the Red Delicious apple that were shiny, big, red, looked good, held up well, but didn't taste very good.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Red Delicious.
Yeah, exactly.
I like them, yeah.
And so I think a lot of plum growers and stone fruit growers found themselves moving that same direction in the 80s and 90s, and I think pluots has helped at least to shift that a little bit.
It's really funny you're talking about just leaving the subject of apples, but one more comment before you do that. The famous Granny Smith apple, which has now been corrupted, I guess, almost like a Red Delicious. Did you know there actually was a Mrs. Smith?
No, I did not know that.
There
was a Mrs. Smith, and she was called Granny Smith, and she had an orchard just in the suburbs of the city of Sydney, in an area which is now a racecourse called Randwick. But it was a successful hot climate apple.
Wow!
Just like our friends in Minnesota were working on
that
good,
cold climate
apple. But let's do this for listeners who only just vaguely know what a stone fruit is,
right?
And really. Would perhaps wonder why you would want to cross a plum and an apricot. What's the taste sensation that's there? You probably ate more than anybody else I can think of.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about really any fruit, but I think especially plums, is the just incredible variety of tastes and flavors just within that one type of fruit. Sort of have plum flavor and peach flavor and nectarine flavor. And I think peaches and nectarines have a little bit more consistency in flavor from variety to variety than do plums. And just back up really quickly, when we talk about stone fruits, we're talking about so-called droop fruits, like that have a pit in the center, peaches, plums, nectarines, cherries. Almonds are actually considered a stone fruit.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. Why are they considered a stone fruit?
Well, we actually eat...
Because if you bite into them, you break your teeth.
we eat the pit. You know, almonds have a kind of a fruit, a flesh that grows up around them, and it's actually the pit, the stone that we eat, rather than the flesh of the fruit. So going back to the flavor of plums, or the taste of plums, you know, I think the one thing that... it's unfortunate that the... probably the most well-known dessert, the best-known dessert using plums, the plum tart, because I feel like that reinforces exactly what many people sort of dislike about plums, is that they have bracing acidity when you bite into them, and especially when you get plums.
I don't like the texture. I don't like the, you never can cut them or anything, you know.
Right. Well, the wonderful thing about pluots is that, and this is true also of a lot of older plums, is that you have a lot of sweetness there to balance out that acidity. And some of these older plums, like the Santa Rosa plum, which was bred by Luther Burbank back in the early 20th century, really the late 19th century, early 20th century, that's a plum that has a wonderful balance of sugar and acidity. And that's, of course, what we taste when we bite into a plum. When we talk about sweetness or flavor, we're really talking about that balance of acidity and sweetness. So plums, for the longest time, plum breeders and plum growers are moving away from that balance in favor of varieties that would hold up well, ship well, were shiny, were large, would look good on the shelf, because that was what was demanded of them from grocery stores, from the supermarkets. And so what the pluot has done, and I think why it has been, why the need for that, for the Zegers were trying to breed plums with apricots, is to lend some of the apricot sweetness back into plums.
Now tell me this. Has this book changed your life?
Well, it has changed my life in one very unimportant way, which is that I now can bore anyone to death at a party by talking about
that ship. I didn't.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's true. I've got the scars to show.
Well, what's next?
No, I remember, Chip, this is funny. I remember we once met a guy who was a particle physicist. And he was the most boring guy on the planet at a cocktail party, but you're close behind him. Huh?
I might be able to give him a run. At least he's practicing what he what he bores people with. I don't even have the benefit of doing that. I'm just I don't grow plums or anything like
but
that.
But what I felt that the end sort of dropped off rather than resolved itself. So what's next for you?
The end of the book, or the
yes,
end of,
I mean,
well,
we don't know really what the full story of the pluot is because we don't know what's going to happen to it.
Right. The interesting thing is one of the growers, and I allude to this a little bit towards the end of the book. One of the growers that I followed for the 2007 season, Family Tree Farms, led by a guy named David Jackson, who's Stone Fruit Royalty, the Jackson family out in California. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who really were leading the charge to having created this, really tried to create this brand, pluot. They were the ones who are now leading the charge to do away with it in favor of the more generic plumcot. So when they told me that at the end of my last reporting trip when I went out to California and was sitting with one of the marketing guys at Family Tree Farms, and he said, "Yeah, we're thinking about just doing away with pluot altogether and really trying to fight the pluot." I said, "Just wait, give me 2 years.
Yeah, otherwise I won't sell any books."
Oh, Chip, you're so funny.
So, but I think that's where we're headed. Last year, I think it was 2008. That's right, yeah, 2008. They were able to get a PLU code, the little stickers, that you see on fruit in the grocery stores and on all produce. They were able to get color codes for plum cots, meaning a black plum cot, a red plum cot, a green plum cot, a yellow plum cot. So I think what you'll see is fewer and fewer pluot signs and more plum cot signs.
Well, listeners, gather around. Here's a man who really needs you to buy his book.
That's right.
and you can buy it on the website, and it's called The Perfect Fruit, Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and The Hunt for the Elusive Pluot and Chip Brantley.
You've been
a fascinating guest, and I can't imagine what you're going to do next, but I'm sure you'll let us know when you do.
I will call you up and bore you with that, too.
Oh, Chip.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
So there you are. You're now an expert on stone fruit.
Yes.
You're familiar with the fascinating story of the plum and apricot that became the pluot or the plumcot or whatever it's going to be called in the future.
Yep.
And we're eating them right now, and they really are very good.
They are good.
They're really
an
excellent contribution to the world of fruits.
Yeah. And it seems like a
shame that one company sort of took over the name, but I suppose they're entitled to do that.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have that problem with this apple that's coming out, except that it takes a long time to get these fruits to market.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that's a different
program because I guess it's a not-for-profit sort of government-funded effort.
Well, it starts that way, and then it goes to something else.
At the University of Minnesota, something crisp was the name of one of the apples, and then there was a new one they were working on that we talked about.
Sweet Tango.
A few months ago, and...
Honeycrisp.
I didn't realize that fruit was nearly that complicated.
No.
And I'm sure you didn't too. And now I think you'll appreciate it even more when the fruit on your plate is there. You'll realize just exactly how much time and energy has gone into developing it and producing it and perfecting it.
You like to talk, but I think we're wrapped.
Are we wrapping the program?
Actually,
it was a slightly shorter program than usual, so I thought we'd
make sure we delivered
some more value to our customers.
So they'll
make sure that they'll come back and see us again next week.
Same time.
Same place. So join us then at On the Menu Radio and have a great week between now and then.
Bye-bye.